These hiking buddies are pretty ragged by the time they summit. Jesus has been wearing them down. They've been trying to keep pace with him in his prophetic teaching, in his healing outcasts, in driving the authorities mad. But this week, he took it further. He did not mince words. He told them what was ahead. The persecution, the public humiliation, the torture, the murder. He would rise, but first he would suffer. Peter argues for another way, and Jesus smacks him down, puts him in his place. But the disciples make it up the mountain. I think maybe they are already in survivor mode. Before the worst has happened, they are already bracing. They are shaken. It's hard to keep moving forward. It's even harder to imagine following Jesus back to Jerusalem, to the mob, to the cross. It's there, sunk by the brokenness, that the disciples step into a thin place. It's a place where the veil between God's realm and earth's dirt is especially permeable. In the flash of a moment, and perhaps only for a moment, everything comes clear. Truth pours out all around them, impossible to mistake. Mine came up on a mountain also. Well, it was actually the high desert, a couple hours north of Phoenix. A small community gathered there on retreat last year. We told our stories. We took stock of our lives. We mapped the years ahead. Several days in, one of the leaders began to sing. As she sang, everything seemed to fall away, leaving the depth of holy truth sitting plainly in the room. As I listened, I saw my life transfigured, God's truth revealed. I should probably back up. I can relate to how the disciples are feeling. I have spent plenty of time there, in that place of hunkering down in survival mode. You know, Peter gets a bad rap here. He's, you know, casually floating the idea of just setting up camp on the mountain, but can we blame him? It's safe. God and the prophets are present. It's beautiful. And again, it's safe. Of course he wants to stay. It is inconceivable to Peter that he could survive without his beloved teacher, his friend, his Messiah. It is hard to wrap his head around it. He's human. I vividly remember a conversation I had about a family who had lost their son just a week before my own son died. I remember saying that I simply could not imagine it, that I had no idea what I would do. And that was true until I was there. I've come to see that this reaction, Peter's and mine, it is so very common. Contemplating life in the wake of horror is baffling. As I heard from folks time and again that it seemed impossible that life would continue, if they were in my shoes, I began to wonder if that was true. I wondered how it could be good again. I wondered what resurrection would look like here for me. And slowly, all this accumulates. It wasn't until I was up in that high desert that I realized how much I had remained in survivor mode. I saw how my living had been shaped by the societal refrain that life after such loss might be impossible. But the transfiguration is not some magic trick or a clever light show. What the disciples encounter and what we lean into from afar, it's revelation. It's not about change like the transmogrifier. You remember this invention that Calvin and Hobbes came up with? It starts out as a cardboard box upside down, and eventually I think it is a water gun that's been upgraded and can zap people into a pig or a pterodactyl. A change in state. That's not what we're talking about. Instead, the transfiguration is a flash of clarity. When, for once, the disciples can see plainly who Jesus is. Hiking up the mountain, they are shoulder to shoulder with his humanity. They are grinding against his mortality, wrestling the anticipation of his nearing death. And in this light, they encounter his divinity streaming from his body. They meet Jesus in his fullness, in his truth. It is terrifying to see this revealed. They hear the Holy One speak from a cloud, and they can't even stand, maybe feigning reverence, but I think they're just petrified. Listen. Listen to him. Listen to him. Jesus can tell that they need a hand, and so he comes close. He touches them. Get up and do not be afraid. But our translation falls short here. Jesus is not cajoling them to their feet. He's inviting them into transformation. Get up is better understood as be raised. This is the word Jesus uses when he speaks of raising Lazarus from the dead. This is how the angel reveals the resurrection to those women at the empty tomb. He is not here. He has been raised. In the midst of their terror and their dread, Jesus is inviting the disciples to live into resurrection now. I was most surprised to receive that same invitation up in the desert. You'd think I would have expected as much going to a gathering of priests, but I can be a little dense. As much as anything, I had grown comfortable with the idea of life being good enough, all things considered, of settling for surviving, for being content, even though part of my family was missing. It's not a terrible thing to settle for. Good enough. It could be a lot worse. But Jesus did not come and teach and die and rise for us to settle. He came that we might have life abundantly. The retreat served as a reunion with a mentor of mine, a priest who had been a leader when I first arrived at seminary. Lisa had taken me in under her wing. She had taught me what it meant to be a woman who persisted. As we caught up, she asked deep, unflinching questions. How was I living with burying my mom and my son in such quick succession? Where did I find healing? How did death weave together with my vocation? She was unafraid. She was present to the fullness of grief and life. And then Lisa sang. She had been teaching, leading a reflection, and then she set it aside and began to sing. May I suggest to you, she sang, May I suggest this is the best part of your life? It struck me as a bold claim, but her lungs were powerful enough to disarm great skepticism. May I suggest this time is blessed for you. This time is blessed and shining, almost blinding bright. She sang a transfiguration into the room. Her words slowly peeled back at the white-knuckled grip I had locked on survival mode. This time, right now, blessed, filled with light. Lisa didn't sing it lightly as a platitude. In the days prior, she had repeated my son's name, Fritz, with tenderness, with understanding. She knew the shape of my life. And still, she sang, looking me in the eye, inviting. May I suggest this is the best part of your life? Perhaps because she had been so ready to enter into the pain, to face the brokenness with me, I had more space for the truth that she was revealing. Lisa sang on words of hope and of promise. As her truth pulled tears from my eyes, I heard her voice begin to crack. I watched as her eyes filled. The truth of God's goodness, present in our brokenness, was cracking us wide open. In the seasons since then, I've heard the calls from Jesus and from God echoing through this music. Listen to him. Be raised and do not be afraid. The refrain of the song, one of possibility, of deep goodness in every present now. This began to replace the refrain of impossibility of life after loss. I began to hear this new refrain of resurrection. We step into Lent this week, and in many ways, I think it's just a pronounced microcosm of our lives. We remember that we are mortal, every one of us. We brave the wilderness. We consider temptation and betrayal. And through it, through our brokenness, we reach for abundant life. In the terror, and in the pain, and in the light, listen, friends. Listen to him. Listen to him. We are called to let our lives be transfigured, to see God's truth revealed in them, to bring our fullest selves into the light. When we are broken, when we do not know the way forward, when we would do anything to escape the pain we've been dealt, this is where God shows up, blazing, dazzling, close. Even there, God is present, beckoning us into resurrection.